It is now approaching 4 months since more than 200 schoolgirls were kidnapped from their dormitory in Nigeria. You'll hear about how a Pakistani teenager's recent efforts hope to bring back the girls. Also on this week's 51%, we turn to a woman who shares what it was like to have her husband leave her shortly after she was diagnosed with cancer.
I don't hold back. I say it exactly like it happened. I don't sugarcoat it. It's not refined. It's the pain that I went through as I was going through it.
It's Raw, which is also the title of her memoir. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Look into their eyes. Let's give them our attention. 'Cause we're on a mission called their life. 'Cause we can bring the darkness to
In April, more than 200 schoolgirls were kidnapped from their dormitory in Nigeria by an Islamist militant group. As Mark Caldwell tells us, a teenage activist who was once a victim of religious extremism recently visited Nigeria in support of the social media campaign #BringBackOurGirls.
In Nigeria, the Bring Back Our Girls campaign has been boosted by a visit from a prominent Pakistani activist. She is 17-year-old Malala Yousafzai, and she was shot in the head by the Taliban in 2012 because of her advocacy for the right of women to an education. She told Nigerians she would join the campaign to secure the release of the 200 schoolgirls seized by Boko Haram in Borno State 3 months ago. Yousafzai met Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, and she said she was able to extract a promise from him about the girls' release, as we hear now in this report from Sam Olukoya.
Malala also met the parents of the more than 200 schoolgirls who were abducted by Boko Haram from their dormitories at the government girls' secondary school, Chibok, Borno State. Some of the parents were in tears when Malala addressed them. Sharing feelings with her, the parents also asked if the president could visit them and have a word with them.
And the president did promise me. He said that he will meet the parents of these girls, and I'm hopeful that these two promises, the return of those girls who are under the abduction of Boko Haram, and meeting the parents of those girls, will be fulfilled, and we would see it really soon.
While Bring Back Our Girls, an international campaign aimed at getting the release of the abducted girls, is internationally seen as a worthy effort to secure the abducted girls, the Nigerian government has not done much to release the girls. On several occasions, the government and its agents, like the police, have tried to disrupt public campaigns for the release of the girls. A pastor whose two daughters were among the abducted girls is unhappy that the government has not done much to release the girls.
Well, since 14th of April, I'm not sure of what is happening, especially the Nigerian government. If they say they are doing something about it, I will say they are not doing anything. We have no hope.
The United Nations and some countries, including the United States, Canada, and China, have sent experts to Nigeria to help in the effort to release the girls. But many believe a lot depends on the Nigerian government, which has to do more. Will Malala's meeting with President Goodluck Jonathan make any difference? Yinka Makinde is one of those who have participated in the campaign to release the girls.
Malala's visit to President Goodluck Jonathan of Nigeria will have a little effect because so many people have spoken. NGOs have spoken, leaders have spoken, people have cried out, women, adults, but nothing has been done yet. But I think if a child could come all the way, a 17-year-old child, maybe he will listen. But if he doesn't listen to the child, then I don't think President Goodluck Jonathan will listen to anybody.
In the meantime, Boko Haram, which is opposed to Western education, has in its latest video mocked effort aimed at releasing the girls.
Sam Olukoya, to put this visit to Nigeria by 17-year-old Malala Yousafzai into perspective, I turn to Husseini Abdu, country director of Action Aid in Nigeria. This NGO is dedicated to eliminating poverty and injustice, issues that cannot be circumvented when discussing the Boko Haram conflict and the lives it has claimed or ruined. Would this visit by a prominent rights campaigner help secure the girls' release?
It may not immediately resolve to securing the schoolgirls, but it could actually help in putting this case of kidnap in a strong international banner. We know this is a major international campaign, so her coming will contribute to that effort in ensuring that people don't lose steam and that this campaign effort actually continues. It could also help in putting pressure on the Nigerian government to do the right thing in ensuring the release of the girls.
Do you have the impression that the Bring Back Our Girls campaign is actually running out of steam?
It's not running out of steam, but this is what some people actually expect it to happen. Of course, in Nigeria, the campaign is quite going on, and there has been 6 in campaigning for the past 70-something days. It is 92 days since the girls have been kidnapped, but that effort is still going on. But we're in a situation where the Nigerian government is getting very uncomfortable with the protests. Very recently, the security agencies called the protesters a franchise and alleging that they are being sponsored and supported by foreign media and foreign agencies, and almost actually calling this protest group a terrorist group. And that is part of a calculated attempt of the government to actually keep people down and allowing the campaign to die a natural death. So her coming is a contribution to the effort of actually keeping it up there and not allowing it to lose steam.
ActionAid, the organization you work for, is an NGO dedicated to fighting poverty and injustice. The north of Nigeria is the poorer part of the country. Do you see a strong link between poverty and the chronic insecurity in the north?
Absolutely. Any society that has that level of poverty that we have in this part of the country, you cannot do without actually having cases of violent conflict. This is a region that actually has about 70% of the people living below poverty line. Poverty makes you susceptible to manipulations by extremists or other elements who actually try to use your vulnerability as a poor person, manipulate you, and actually put you and use you for this kind of violence. And that's what we're experiencing. Part of the way to deal with this issue is that we have to fight poverty. We have to make sure that people are actually in school. Government need to create jobs so that young people are not idle and used by terrorist elements like Boko Haram.
Hussaini Abdu, Country Director of ActionAid in Nigeria.
Africa Link, because Africa is more than just a headline.
In a blink, they were taken without a choice. With no reason, they were taken without a voice. So very young, I know that they are so afraid. But hold on, we gotta take this day by day.
In the summer of 2010, and 5 months into her battle with stage 3 colon cancer, Fiona Finn's husband left her on Father's Day and after 10 years of marriage. Since remission, Finn has become an advocate for women coping with spousal abandonment after a diagnosis of a serious illness. She cites a 2009 study in the Cancer Journal that found the divorce rate for cancer-stricken wives is approximately 21% as compared to 3% when husbands become seriously ill. Raw, One Woman's Journey Through Love, Loss, and Cancer is her tell-all memoir that also offers encouragement and even humor. I spoke with Finn about her book and why she chose to reveal such a personal experience.
The catalyst for me writing the book was the fact that I had been through cancer, and during the cancer, my husband abandoned me and my children. It was a pivotal time in my life. I had always talked about writing a book, and had I not gone through those two experiences, I probably never would have written a book.
How did you get through that experience?
I think by the grace of God and my finding that I had the talent of writing. I started journal writing, and the more I would journal, the more it became a book, and it was a way to heal. And so I think that was really what helped me.
Raw is one of those words that it speaks volumes. You don't have to explain it. It just is. And then I read that, about war spelled backwards. So did you name it because of the spelling backwards?
I'd like to say I completely picked Raw because of it. I picked Raw. I just felt compelled to use that word. It's written in a very raw way. It's very shocking. As people will read it, I don't hold back. I say it exactly like it happened. I don't sugarcoat it. It's not refined. it's the pain that I went through as I was going through it. And then, you know, halfway during the book, I realized, wow, raw spells wore backwards. And, you know, I'm really close to trying to become an advocate for women whose husbands leave them, being that more husbands leave than wives leave during a cancer diagnosis. So I believe there is a war going on against wives, and they're being left on the cancer battlefield, and that I just wanted to bring awareness to that.
Why do you think that happens? Why do you think leaving during that time?
Boy, you know, that's probably the million-dollar question. I'm raising two sons, so I'm just as curious why husbands tend to leave more than wives do. You know, you make a vow. I think both people usually go into making that vow with their hearts truly intending to uphold it. But there's something to be said when more men turn away at the most important time when you need a spouse or a partner in a time of illness. So I don't want my sons to grow up, make a vow, and walk out on their spouses, nor would I want their spouse to do the same. So I don't really have the answers. Some have said caretaking, men are not caretakers, but you know, I think that if you love someone, you'll do everything in your power to help them during those times.
You know, what you've done is turn this around and make sure your sons, you know, don't turn around and do what their father did, but instead, you know, live by your words and advice. How do you think they've assimilated that? How do you think that, you know, how are they after all of this?
You know, my children is probably the one thing I had the hardest time writing about. When I wrote the book, I actually had left the chapter out about them. But my editor said, you cannot, as a mother, leave your children out of this story. I think I had a tremendous amount of guilt for what I had put them through by bringing not just one father, but then a stepfather into my son's lives. Both of them, you know, having a tremendous amount of issues themselves with addictions and, you know, turning and abandoning them. So I can never guarantee that my children won't do what they've seen, but at least they will hear from me over and over and over what they should be doing, what the choice that they should be making.
Wait, there were two?
There are two. A lot of people think that the book is solely about the cancer and my second husband abandoning us, but it's not. I mean, that, as I said, was the catalyst, but I went through two marriages. Very loyal. I would have thought that I would have been married to one man my whole life, but both of my husbands actually had addictions, and they had the same addiction, and neither time did I know it. So I felt that I really needed to look into, you know, what was I drawing into my life? I found out, you know, through therapy that I was a codependent, and I was always bringing a narcissist into my life, and that I wanted to change them, help them, you know, be their moral compass. And that's exhausting. You can't do that for another person.
The addiction, you said, is the same.
Yeah, drug addiction, cocaine. And, you know, I come from a family. My father actually struggled with alcohol, but there was no actual drug addiction. My mother was superwoman. She did everything and tried to hide everything. And I love both of them to death. But again, sometimes you end up doing what you see rather than what you hear. So that's why I don't think there's any guarantees that my sons won't draw in the kind of negative love experiences I've drawn in. But all I can do is tell them, hey, you know, I'm here. And no matter how angry and upset you are, I still love you.
What do you hope whoever reads this will get from this? And was it therapeutic for you?
So it's a double-edged sword. Yeah, there was a lot of therapy and healing gained by writing, but then putting yourself so much out there. You know, sometimes I do have regrets in having every one of my own secrets out there, but I did it in order to help any other woman that was going through anything that I've been through, to let her know that you can make it through the other side. There's light at the end of the tunnel. And all I've learned from everything I've been through is you have to be your own best friend, and you really have to love yourself. I know people have heard that in the past, but it's more than words. If you don't love yourself, you're going to draw in all these negative experiences because that's what's coming towards you. It's kind of feeding that lack. And once you heal yourself and fill yourself with love, that's all you're going to draw in.
What has been the response? What has surprised you in the response to your book?
I think that the journey has been a difficult one. Just as a career, I have come out of real estate. For 13 years, I was in real estate with my husband, the one that left, my second husband. We were spouses selling houses. Transitioning into a new career, I have kept my license available, but I found this love of writing, and now I just want to try and make an income off of it. So, you know, that's totally two different things. I love sharing the message, but at the same time, I still have children and needs. So I'm trying to balance that. That's a real balancing act. One thing I found is I've become a Huffington Post blogger, and I absolutely love that. It's wonderful being able to touch people and know that there are people that are reading, you know. But the book is an indie book. I'm an indie author. I never approached, you know, any publisher. I just felt I wanted to get the word out, and I'm really proud of myself because probably the publishers would have tried to change and twist my words into something more beautiful, less raw. And I'm glad it's raw. I'm happy with the outcome of the book.
I wanted to ask you about going into a psychiatric ward.
Yes.
Because you tried to commit suicide.
Correct.
I'm hoping you can, if you wouldn't mind talking about this.
No. So after my husband left, you know, he tried to come back at one point, but we never moved back in together. No matter how hard I tried to please him while I was going through my illness and save the marriage, I could not save the marriage. His heart was not in it. And he was very upset that people knew he had left. So I think he was just doing a little bit of saving face. And then he, at Thanksgiving, said, that's it. It's completely over with no chance of us, you know, saving our 10-year marriage. So between Thanksgiving and January, I really struggled. But I realized you have to let somebody go. You can't hold on so tight. So I signed the divorce papers. And within, I think, 2 months, he moved in with a woman. And we were struggling with our daughter in visitation. And she came to the door when I went to pick my daughter up. And she screamed at me that, you know, I didn't know what was going on. And I wasn't very smart. And that they would try and take my daughter away. And I just was so disheartened and felt, you know, that I just didn't know what was going on, that I decided that I just didn't want to be anymore. I don't want to feel any more pain. I didn't want to be so alone. I really thought I knew who he was. I know that sounds strange, but I would have sworn in my life that I knew who he was and what judgment he would make. And I was wrong. And that was really hard for me. So I, even though I had children, I couldn't see my children in that moment. I just wanted the pain to stop. So I took every bit of medication I had. From the chemo, everything, and I took it all at once. My older son found me, brought me to the hospital, and they pumped my stomach, where at that point I was put into a psychiatric ward for crisis stabilization. And that's where I was. That was my low point. So it was actually a really good place to be for me to start to accept what was over and what I still had in my life.
Are you in a relationship now?
No, I toy with the idea of it. I've been approached. I tried a little match.com, which I wrote about. I think it was fun. But, you know, again, I'm a little weary because of the past relationships I've had, and I tend not to be a very good picker. So I'm a little bit weary. I do want, certainly, to have love again in my life, and I hope it comes to me in a natural way. But at this point, no, and I'm still really working on trying to heal different facets of my life.
Did you have anyone you could turn to for help?
You know, I have family here, but what happened was my family's working class, and they have jobs, and they weren't able to, you know, be readily available to me for each and every moment. So when he left, I think that was the hardest. I was struggling with neuropathy, where your arms and your nerves sometimes don't work. And I would try to go to drive to the grocery store, and I would be there, and all of a sudden everything went numb. So, you know, I had the bagger crying for me because she couldn't believe that I had to try and drive myself home. I couldn't take anything back out of the cart. And so she's like, you're the very first person I've ever wanted to actually drive home. So, you know, it was, everything was a struggle. And at some point my parents said, that's it. You just have to come move in with us. We have to do what we can for you. To help feed the children, to help. You can't do this on your own. So I did move in with them, and for a short time, you know, I wanted to be independent. I struggled with that so much. My family and I, my children and I, we've moved 9 times in 4 years. Mm. So poverty hit us hard. My husband actually didn't just leave us. He took everything. He left us penniless.
Is there something else you wanted to talk about or point out, Fiona?
Well, I mean, you know, one of the biggest things for me in being so open, you know, because when you open yourself up, you open yourself up to the criticism, which I can certainly handle, is that I don't want people to just take this book and think it's just cancer and it's just abandonment. I'm telling almost every woman that would read it, that you're going to relate to something in there because it's over 20 years. So I think that it will laugh. I think I'm humorous, and a lot of people will think, oh, that's a sad book. But I'm honestly, for every time I tell you something sad, I try and make you laugh by the end of the chapter. So I think that that's something that I have a lot of people wouldn't know.
That was Fiona Finn, author of Raw, One Woman's Journey Through Love, Loss, and Cancer.
Stinging like a bee, I earned my stripes.
Some people turn to ginger or chamomile tea to calm their stomachs or ease other simple ailments, while one Virginia researcher is lab testing curcumin, a popular Indian remedy extracted from the root turmeric. Allison Quance reports on what the lab has found.
Arti Narayanan grew up in southern India, in tropical Chennai.
Because we had a standing body of water, we had a fairly lush backyard with all kinds of plants and trees. We also had lots of mosquitoes. And, you know, for whatever reason, I was a sitting duck. I was very sensitive to mosquito bites.
When young Narayanan would get eaten up by mosquitoes, her family rubbed a paste of turmeric onto the bites.
Turmeric was the go-to for everything growing up. Cuts, insect bites, anything that would break your skin.
Westerners are most familiar with turmeric as a bright yellow spice for cooking. But when Narayanan's family used it as medicine,
it was always freshly ground. It's like ginger. It has that kind of moist consistency to it. It's very fibrous. You can rub it on any kind of a rough surface and make a paste out of it.
Narayanan's family put it in warm milk or mixed it with tea. She says it was the default response if anything in your body wasn't feeling quite right.
If I call home and if they sense that I have a sore throat, you know, did you drink milk with turmeric? That's the immediate gut response.
Narayanan is now a researcher at George Mason University's National Center for Biodefense and Infectious Diseases. And she's testing whether curcumin, a component of turmeric, really does have medicinal properties. So far, the results have been encouraging.
We have some lab data that says that it can inhibit at least three different kinds of viruses and inhibit those viruses fairly potently.
But curing cells in a lab is pretty different than curing people with viruses. One of the biggest drawbacks to curcumin is that it might be leaving your system too quickly to do much good.
What the scientific community would call limited bioavailability.
Researchers are already looking for ways around that. A Dr. Bharat Agarwal in Texas came up with a slow-release patch, sort of like a nicotine patch, that would release curcumin in your body over time.
And it can be partly alleviated by mixing curcumin with black pepper, which is known to stabilize the structure of curcumin itself and make it more bioavailable. So if we can overcome that hurdle, I think this would hold a lot of promise.
Some studies also suggest that curcumin could help fight more serious diseases like cancer or Alzheimer's. In the meantime, if you feel a cold coming on, you can give Narayanan's recipe a shot.
Warm milk, a spoon of honey, a pinch of turmeric, and a pinch of black pepper. Mix it up and drink it.
For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Allison Quance.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear the show again or visit the 51% archives, you may visit our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1305. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%.